lot of innocent people murdered by the Lee Furrow gang. Could you venture some thoughts in that direction? Well, the bloody coveralls were brought in by the girlfriend. That evidence was destroyed. Everybody knows that around this case. So, just opening that door a little bit. That's how critical. Broader implications of your case. The broader implications.
Oh, if the governor looks at my case with an open mind, sees what damn if everybody else looks at my case sees. Potentially shut down the death penalty out here in California. Because this is not deserving to me. I am not so special of a person that these prosecutors and these police would disrate me. They would withhold evidence in my case and not do it in nobody else's case. I'm just lucky enough to have the people who I've had fight for me to expose this stuff. But this is running rampant throughout this criminal justice system. It's really nasty. So hopefully, if we can put some rhythm in my situation, we can stop this thing from being started back up. And I'm committed to see that it doesn't start back up. I'm on the front line of this one. And if I never get up out of here, I'm gonna be right here with you. And if my voice is yours, you shut this thing down for good. Yes, you can jump what they say, because I can't hear. I'm worried about what some NBC theaters only have 2 months to speak up. And that's a damn shame. But that's life. That's reality.
And this ties into what's happened subsequently. The bloody coveralls were turned in by a woman named Diane Roper, who lived with Lee Furrow in Mentone, which is right, I think, I don't know, 70-some-odd% of the adult population in that town had been in prison, had been in jail, including Lee Furrow, who was part of, somebody mentioned, the gang who brutally murdered Sue Kitts, 17 or 18-year-old girl, because she, they were afraid she was going to spill the beans on Clarence Ray Allen. Okay, so you've got these coveralls, and for the longest period of time, an officer with the sheriff's department said that nobody asked him about the coveralls, and so he just decided to throw them away. And he threw away bloody coveralls. I mean, anybody you ask, they go, nobody in their right mind would do that. Well, it gets worse. We learned, and this is a fact that was not known at the time of trial, it was not known all throughout his appeals until we discovered it in 2004, that not only did he throw away the coveralls, but he was in fact instructed by Sergeant Schreckengast to do exactly that. And he did exactly that. These coveralls were coveralls that were turned in, found in the closet of Lee Furrow's home. The other fact that really set things going is a woman who lives up in Nevada City, and if I'm going on in too much detail, I'll stop, you know, and you guys can read all about this. By the way, the book Scapegoat, the Chino Hills murders and the framing of Kevin Cooper, I highly recommend it. It's an award-winning book by a guy named Ted O'Connor, who wrote a book on Mumia first, and then he wrote this book. But in any event, a woman was watching TV, and she saw that the governor, Schwarzenegger at the time, had denied clemency. And she then calls the governor's office and says, wait a minute, Kevin Cooper did not, she's just, you know, our question was, where the hell have you been? That Kevin Cooper did not commit this, and that in fact she was in a bar with two other women, one of whom she couldn't remember, one of whom she could. Three men walked into the bar. This woman is a phlebotomist by profession, by the way, so she knows, presumably, when she sees blood. And saw three men walk in, each of them had blood on them. And so she called the governor's office to disclose this information. The governor's secretary answered the phone and said, thank you very much, we'll be back in touch with you. They did not get back in touch with her. The next or 2 days later, she called me, and we were off to the races. And then, as I say, ultimately, or shortly thereafter, that was the week before Kevin was to be killed, we were able to get a stay. Now, last thing, and then I'll stop. Just to give you a sense on the people involved, one of the persons who was with the sheriff's department at the time was, he actually resigned, they never went after him criminally, for stealing 5 pounds of heroin from the evidence locker in another case and selling it. That was one of the key investigators in the case. The second person is the sheriff, Tidwell at the time, who he and his sons did plead guilty to stealing rifles and other guns that are recovered in the course of crimes. So that was Sheriff Tidwell at the time. And then the third person is a fellow by the name of Gregonis. He's still there. This is not the first time he's been accused of this tampering. There's a case just about to be argued before the Court of Appeals accusing him of planting, which is what we had here. So, a couple things I want to mention because there are some notable people here. One is Lisa Perlman, and if you don't know Lisa, she has written a book called The Sky's the Limit, which is about a number of different cases throughout the 20th century, and she is now separating out the death penalty trial of Huey Newton into its own book, and is close to completing a documentary that, what's Richter's first name?
Bob
Richter in New York is directing, and it's I've seen parts of it. It's superb, and the book is really well, very, very well written. So I want to recognize these for being here. And there are some brochures, so keep... I think, unless anybody has any questions or wants to, I'll hang around. May 1 rally, the Longshoremen are having a rally in San Francisco. I'm not sure exactly where it starts, but it's easy to find out. Richard, you know?
There's actually going to be two marches happening on May Day, which is about 2 weeks from now. One of them is going to be in San Francisco. ILWU Local 10, which is the Longshoremen, are going to be going on strike. And in the East Bay, there's also going to be a march. Now, the brother over there earlier on had asked what it is that we could do for Kevin. And one very obvious thing is, I'm not certain about this, but there are some indications that possibly Bernie Sanders may march with one of the contingents on May Day. So if he does that, there's going to be upwards of 10,000 people marching with one of the contingents either in San Francisco or over in the East Bay. So if you were inclined to do something for Kevin Kugler and you're free on May Day, which is a Sunday, so, you know, hopefully you don't have to work, you know, everybody in this room knows more than enough about Kevin to be able to educate other people and pass out flyers or, like, man a table so that we can tell people about his case and raise awareness. So if you're up for doing that, it would be a tremendous help. I'm going to pass around a sign-up sheet, and if you're willing to help out with that, please sign up on there. And also, you can approach me after the event is over, and, you know, we can exchange contact information.
Speaking of signing up, if you haven't signed the petition to support putting ending the death penalty on the ballot, we have that there. We also have a petition that you can sign support Kevin Cooper, that will go to the governor, so we'd be kind enough to do that. We got all sorts of stuff, we got t-shirts, I mean, all this stuff goes to help fight the cause. Yes, Lisa?
What's the time frame? When is the governor expected to act
on it? Oh, that's a very good question. We wish we knew. We submitted February 17th or so our petition for clemency. There is no set time for the Attorney General's office. Presumably Mike Ramos, who is now the sheriff of San Bernardino County. And so we don't know, and we're in contact with the person in charge of clemency, obviously, at the governor's office. And that's a very interesting story. Among the five judges who joined with Judge Fletcher saying that the state of California may be about to execute an innocent man was Judge Paez. And Judge Paez is the person who would be, Judge Paez's clerk, former law clerk, is the person who's now in charge of the clemency.
And never say ah, because it gives the DJ chance to jump in, especially Tuesday at noon, this being DJ Miles. So the, well, let me just back it up a tiny bit from...
And Judge Paez is the first one. Judge Paez is the first one.
The wording that I plainly didn't get on this, well, there was much going on and it took us a long time to get the chat with Des Rowe going, and then I forget what I'm gonna say, but, oh yeah, so that quote, right where I stopped it, 24 minutes and 29 seconds into the Kevin Cooper San Quentin call, DJ Mouse live from Death Row. Doug Fletcher said, the state of California may be about to execute an innocent man. Didn't say was about to execute someone who may be innocent, but murder someone who was innocent. That I didn't want to leave out of this part, but I did put it on my little IndieBay. If you go to Racial Justice, State of California on IndieBay and look for the audio of this call, you can probably find it.
With Judge Paez, and Judge Paez is the person who is, Judge Paez's clerk, former law clerk, is the person who's now in charge of the clemency aspect of the governor's office. So there you go.
Well, there, I said, so maybe I could, or no, somebody said, never mind, the judge to remember is Huff, the judge who's the candidate for California Death Row, San Quentin, where this call was taking place. Back to the Omni Commons Saturday night.
I just wanted to bring to your attention, we have a newspaper here called Endeavor. This was the newspaper that was edited by Shaka Sankofa or Gary Graham when he was imprisoned, you know, in Texas. Very interesting because this brother, when he was arrested when he was 17, he became a national leader of the death penalty, you know, the struggle against the death penalty from inside prison through this paper. You might be interested in reading it. It's there for your taking. Thank you.
Oh, on Shaka Sankofa, Gary Graham, all the eyewitnesses said it wasn't him except the one that was the furthest away.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was a detail. Thanks.
Are you listening, Audacity? Okay. I always tell people it's the Mercury because, my OCSI, this is the mouse report, this is not going to matter, even though I obsessively and compulsively play it. So, where were we? Oh yeah, that was on vaccines, and about which, just tell people if they ask, to explain this path, it's the Mercury. Never mind. Back to something or other here, MSM, blind to our war. Must be the mouse report. Okay, here we go with No Shit Radio. Because of course you can't say shit on radio. The old big lie. the MSM mission to accuse the Saudis while simultaneously covering up evidence that Western corporations and Western government leaders were really behind many of the Saudi links. Here are a few of the surprising connections between Saudi Arabia and the Westerners who were in one way or another related to the 9/11/01 Pentagon holiday, let's say. Kevin Ryan uses the word attacks, but that's so misleading. You cannot attack yourself. Bernard Carrick, the New York City Police Commissioner and 9/11, quote, hero, unquote, spent 3 years working in Saudi Arabia in the 70s for a company that occupied one of the WTC towers at the time of the attacks. He then spent another 3 years in Saudi Arabia in the 80s as the chief investigator for the royal family. It was Carrick who first told the public that explosives were not used at WTC, and that it was his police department that was said to have discovered the magic passport which fell from one of the towers to conveniently provide evidence identifying one of the alleged hijackers. DJ Mouse is not making this stuff up. If you woke up yesterday, I mean, were born yesterday. One of the two primary companies to manage the cleanup of Ground Zero, Bovis, B-O-V-I-S, Lend-Lease, had previously built the Riyadh Olympic Stadium in Saudi Arabia. The other primary cleanup company at Ground Zero, AMEC, had just completed a $258 million refurbishment of Wedge 1 of the Pentagon, which is exactly where Flight 77 impacted the building. AMEC is a major international player in the oil and gas industry as well as in other natural resource industries. AMEC had a significant presence in Saudi Arabia dating back to the late 1970s, providing support to the national oil company Saudi Aramco. The company that designed the security systems for the WTC complex, Kroll Associates, had strong connections to Saudi Arabia. For example, Kroll board member Raymond Mavis was the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia in the mid-90s. All four of the primary contractors that were involved in rebuilding security systems for the WTC had done significant business with the Saudis. Electronic Systems Associates parent SNH Design, King Saud University, and EJ Electric worked for Saudi Arabian Airlines. NSEC was owned by a former arms dealer to the Saudis. Stratasec, which had contracts not only for the WTC, but also for Dulles Airport, where Flight 77 took off, and United Airlines, which owned two of the three other planes, worked under a, quote, joint venture agreement with Ahmad N. Al-Binali and Sons, a large Saudi Arabian engineering and construction company, to develop and conduct business in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. The Bush and Bin Laden financed Carlyle Group, owned through BDM International, the Vinell, V-I-N-N-E-L-L Corporation, a mercenary operation that had extensive contracts in the Middle East since 75 and trained the Saudi Arabian National Guard. Several of Stratasec's key employees, including COO Barry McDaniel, came from BDM, BDM, oh yeah, up there, I remember. In 95, BDM's Vinell was one of the first targets of Al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia. In the 90s, Science Applications International Corporation, SAIC, run by Dick Cheney, protege Dwayne Andrews, trained the Saudi Navy and brought Saudi military personnel to company headquarters in San Diego. For further study, SAIC played a large part in the NIST WTC investigation after 9/11, but was also involved in the investigation of the 93 World Trade Center bombing, boasting that, quote, after the 93 World Trade Center bombing, our blast analysis produced tangible results that helped identify those responsible, unquote. Oh, you mean that? Well, that was in South America, the mushroom cloud over what was supposedly from a fertilizer bomb parked in the street, but fertilizer bombs, that is, should be the name of the MSM, never mind as far as BS. But, supposedly helped identify those possible, end quote, or I was putting in supposedly.
SAIC was paid huge sums to rebuild the NSA FBI system that supposedly failed before 9/11, while SAIC was training the Saudi Navy, the Carlisle BVM subsidiary Bunnell Corp was training the Saudi Arabian National Guard. Simultaneously, Booz Allen Hamilton was managing the Saudi Marine Corps and running the Saudi Armed Forces Staff College. Former FBI Director Louis Freeh, whose agency investigated al-Qaeda attributed terrorism from 93 to 2001, is now personal attorney for Saudi Ambassador Bandar Bush. Solomon Smith Barney, the company that occupied all but 10 floors of the WTC Building 7, was taken over by Citigroup in 98. Now, Solomon Building, of course, but, oh yeah, that was aside, the grandmothers from Black Mesa area were in that building weeks before it wasn't there anymore, and it wasn't any spooky supernatural powers, unlike the Carson, okay, no, but, never mind. Solomon Smith, oh yeah, the Solomon Brothers, but Lehman Brothers, that's right. So, September 15, 2008, the end of the Poppy Bush dictatorships are, now they've got their underlings, so the lesser evil. Never mind. Solomon Smith Barney, the company that occupied all but 10 floors of WTC7, was taken over by Citigroup in 98. Citigroup had recently been saved from bankruptcy by Prince Al-Waleed of Saudi Arabia in a deal brokered by the Carlyle Group. Of course, Carlyle Group took over the Freescale software, that corporation that had four of its executives on board whose patents had been granted 4 days after the disappearance of the first of several paybacks to Malaysia. So you see, cui bono. Now, the Kennedy-killing Hitler banksters cannot keep from cashing in when they're arming both sides and committing a crime, basically arming the enemy, aiding and comfort to the enemy. They're going to know to cash in on the put options and all that. They're going to bet on the loss, betting that they will lose because, of course, they are the reason that they're losing. So they got that certainty about things. That's how they can predict so well in such a thing as a stock market. So that was Carlyle Group, the Hitler's bank, that the... So on the board of this Solomon Smith Barney, you've got both Cheney and Rumsfeld, but we'll get to that. Solomon Smith Barney, company occupied all but 10 floors of WTC7, was taken over by Citigroup in 98. Citigroup had recently been saved from bankruptcy by Prince Ali of Saudi Arabia, and the deal broker by the Carlyle Group. It is believed that the money and more came from the terrorist financing network, VCCI. As it was dissolving, Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney joined the advisory board at Solomon Smith Barney at the time and were on the board until they resigned to join the Bush administration in January 2001. So they weren't on the board during 9/11. Okay, I got it. The Saudi government was sued by thousands of 9/11 victims' family members, but due to the suspicion that Saudi Arabia helped finance al-Qaeda, al-Qaeda is the Arabic for CIA Contra Army Database, the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, the Afghan Arabs. Of course, Afghanistan was not Arab until like 1800s, it became Islamized, so quote-unquote. Saudis hired the law firm of Bush administration insider James Baker to defend them in that lawsuit. Summers and Swan seem to have missed these interesting connections between U.S. government officials and corporations in Saudi Arabia. That seems odd for a book that pretends to be the definitive work to date. That book is the 11th day or 11th hour or whatever. That seems an odd book to be today. Despite this inconsistency, it is doubtful that Richard Clark, 9/11 Commission staffer Miles Kerr, NPR's Alex Kingsbury, or any other supporter of the government's reports will say anything about it. Oh, that was from Kevin Ryan, co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies, and it said George Washington to blogspot.de, but he's also on Dig Within, playing to get into Saudi Arabia free card. So that's the theme of all this. Okay, now let's look at the Saudis. Let's still put the blame on the other side of the color line. Blame impossible hijacking, never mind, no steel frame structure in history. Planes couldn't fly at that speed. No cell phones from 30,000 feet. And two crashing makes three implode. All that idiocy. They're rubbing our nose in the fact that, we are rubbing your nose, world, in the fact that we are evil. We got a gun pointed at your head. And, when you wake up looking down the barrel of a gun, you lie and say friend to the friend or foe question. When the guy's waving the smoking gun and saying, did anybody see anything? Nobody sees anything because we appease the oppressor to survive. And then we internalize that denial, and out comes rationalizations, Before I say anything gross, I'm going to go back to, what was it? Oh, my last show. Let me go back to the last show, because that's always better. I always did it better last time. You ever notice how that is? Hurry up, iTunes. I'm going back to last week. Oh, but I got this new stuff. Oh, I didn't play Gerald's, but... Sorry, Gerald, I'll try to get you playing Sunday at noon. Or Saturday at noon. I could do that, because Sunday I'm all up to my eyeballs at the People's Park anniversary. It's going to be happening this Sunday. I guess I'm right here.
2:02:03, and guess what? Tuesday.
As the circus of the 2016 presidential election grinds on, Hillary Clinton has posited herself as the candidate of the people. But not many candidates of the people have vacation homes in the Hamptons that cost $200,000 per month, or hang out with the world's billionaires. It's hard to know who she really is. While once being a proponent of Donald Trump-type positions like building a wall at the Mexican border, supporting torture, and opposing same-sex marriage until 2013, today, Hillary Clinton presents herself as the anti-Trump, anti-Republican candidate. There's been a lot of outrage about the impression that the establishment has already anointed her as the Democratic nominee and has carved out her path to the presidency. But like in 2008, her guaranteed seat on the throne is being derailed by the unpredictable moods of the masses and millions of young progressive voters. She continues to play her shape-shifting game, morphing her positions to try to capture the support from her opponent. But the real Hillary is still inside. In fact, every layer of Hillary's career shows why. Far from being a candidate of the people, she's the top pick by corporations to do the real job of any U.S. president, be the CEO of the empire. And they're working hard to keep her on that path to the throne. Having been party insiders for decades, the Clintons have manipulated D.C. reporters, mastered the media spin, and have a well-oiled PR machine at their beck and call.
Hillary Clinton has done everything right. She has run a good campaign. She has outperformed in debates. She's raised money. She's got a great ground game.
As a Latina, I can tell you that Latinos all over the country are very excited about Hillary. Latina women are very excited about Hillary.
Knew from the beginning that when the conversation turned to foreign policy, that this was going to be when Hillary Clinton really shined. And I think that that whole exchange was probably one of her strongest moments of the night.
Undisclosed is that many of the people praising Hillary across the corporate media work at firms employed by Clinton's campaign and super PACs. It's not just paid pundits, but the reporters and owners themselves. From Chris Matthews to the head of the New York Times, a big gang of media personalities have financial and personal ties to the Clintons. But even with Citizens United and unfettered corporate funding, the establishment can't prevent an insurgent candidate like Bernie Sanders from winning with votes, which is why back in 1984, the Democratic Party created a superdelegate process to further undermine democracy. Here's how it works. There's about 4,000 pledged delegates divided by primary and caucus results. But there's an additional 700 superdelegates that remain unpledged, meaning they can vote against the people's will to ensure nominees are handpicked party insiders. The single vote of a superdelegate is worth thousands of ours. Many of these people are current and former members of Congress, but dozens more are literally corporate lobbyists, working on behalf of every industry from healthcare to private prisons. Like superdelegate Tonio Burgos, Pfizer lobbyist and Clinton fundraiser. Or superdelegates Jill Apler, Minion Moore, and Maria Cardona at Dewey Square Group, a lobbying firm that works directly with the Clinton campaign and lobbied on behalf of healthcare corporations to craft Obamacare for their benefit. Then there's superdelegate Jeff Berman, top lobbyist at Brian Cave, and former lobbyist for the Keystone XL Pipeline and Geo Group private prisons. Berman is even paid by the Clintons to round up other superdelegate votes. This unelected nobility comprises one-third of all delegates needed to secure the Democratic nomination. And the Clintons are surrounded by a flock of Democratic Party politicians who know the career benefits of hitching their wagon to the most powerful family in Washington. And with bills cajoling, Hillary had at least 500 superdelegate pledges under her belt months before the election had even begun. A 45-1 delegate lead over Sanders. This insane Democratic inversion plays out every time Sanders crushes a state, like in Wyoming, where he won by double digits but walked away with the same number of delegates. It's not just superdelegates investing in Hillary. Every arm of the corporatocracy has been hedging their bets on her for almost two decades. Alongside media conglomerates Cablevision and Time Warner, five of Hillary's top 10 political donors since 1999 have been some of the most powerful banks. Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, and Lehman Brothers. But those numbers pale in comparison to how much Wall Street firms have graciously donated to Hillary's super PAC, to the tune of $15 million. Beyond banks, every industry has been buying into another Clinton presidency. Lobbying groups for private prison giants Geo Group and Corrections Corporation of America are bundling dollars to the Ready for Hillary PAC. Hillary's also been given more money from Big Pharma than any other candidate, and received over a third of total contributions given out by pharmaceutical giants. The defense industry thinks she's good for business too. Defense contractor employees have given her more cash than any other candidate. Fossil fuel lobbyists are also working hard to elect Hillary. Her 2016 campaign received more than $4.5 million from lobbyists, bundlers, and donors connected to the world's biggest polluters. Their investment will pay off tenfold. Hillary has been at the forefront of promoting fracking, a dangerous and destructive method of natural gas extraction. And she's much more than just a supporter of fracking. She personally created a bureau at the State Department focused on spreading it around the world with one of her major sponsors, Chevron. The Clintons sell their friendship through other avenues, such as huge honorariums for speaking fees. Much like George W. Bush's motivational speaking tour, Bill and Hillary are quick to exploit themselves for corporate loot. But they don't come cheap. Averaging $211,000 a pop, Bill and Hillary made more than $153 million in paid speeches to elite think tanks and closed-door boardrooms since 2001. In 2013, the year after leaving the State Department, Hillary made $3 million giving just 12 speeches to Wall Street banks and financial institutions. This calculates to her earning $5,000 per minute. Seems like good, honest work to me. Demands to release the speech transcripts have been laughed off by Hillary. But we don't really need to see the transcripts because we already know what's in them. Her praising banks and committing to their prosperity. Although Hillary has recently tried to appear critical of Wall Street to pander to Sanders' immense support, her fat cat banker donors aren't worried in the slightest, saying her talking points about inequality are, quote, just politics. But how did Hillary Clinton become such a political force that the empire's biggest powerhouses and establishment elites flocked to her with money and support? Hillary was born in 1947 to a wealthy textile wholesaler who unsuccessfully ran for public office. She has two brothers, one a failed businessman, the other a failed politician. Both have their own history of public scandals. Hillary's first political work was campaigning for the Donald Trump of the 60s, far-right Republican Barry Goldwater. Hillary maintains that she was proud to be a Goldwater girl and writes off her support for the offensive character as just youthful ignorance. But the timing tells a different story. This was in 1964, when the Civil Rights Act was passed, after the Freedom Rides, after MLK's I Have a Dream speech at the historic March on Washington. Goldwater's campaign was an open reaction to that. Later, Hillary became president of the Young Republicans Club at her elite university. She says she later transformed, which is a common thing for Hillary, but her conservative past is more tied to her rise than she wants you to know. The Clintons' climb to prominence had everything to do with the political climate in the country. During the Civil Rights period, the Republican Party emerged as the new choice for racist whites. Reagan's sweeping victories in the South, ushering in 12 years of Republican administrations, put the Democratic Party in a panic. A younger movement within the party formed to win back the Southern vote, known as the New Democrats. And it did so through a conservative shift, canceling out hallmark Great Society economic policies and appealing to anti-black attitudes by distancing themselves from prominent black Democrats, targeting mythical welfare queens, and pushing so-called criminal reforms that targeted African Americans.
They're a new generation of Democrats, Bill Clinton and Al Gore, and they don't think the way the old Democratic Party did. They've called for an end to welfare as we know it, so welfare can be a second chance, not a way of life. They've sent a strong signal to criminals by supporting the death penalty.
Bill swept the Southern white vote on his ending welfare as we know it and tough on crime coded racism.
We're making some progress. Much of it is related to the initiative called community policing, because we have finally gotten more police officers on the street. That was one of the goals that the president had when he pushed the crime bill that was passed in 1994. They are not just gangs of kids anymore. They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy. We can talk about why they ended up that way, but first we have to bring them to heel.
Hillary Clinton tries to rationalize her support for these measures today as having unintended consequences. But they were precisely designed to target African Americans. At the helm of a right turn for the party, politicians flocked to the Clintons, which brought a new era of Democratic Party politics, adapting to the changing needs of empire. Neoliberalism was enacted through NAFTA, decimating American jobs and economies abroad. Massive deregulation of Wall Street and the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act set the stage for an economic crisis. Clinton's crime bill exploded our shameful era of mass incarceration. When the Clintons left the White House in 1999, their rise to political powerhouses was really just the beginning, despite Bill's numerous sexual harassment cases. With a plan to put Hillary in the Oval Office next, they moved to their new home state of New York, where Hillary became a senator the following year. While wealthy, the Clintons had nowhere near the money they have today. On their 1999 tax returns, they made less than $500,000. But by 2014, they were making more than 50 times that amount, reporting over $28 million in income. And that only scratches the surface of the cash supplies they've amassed. While Hillary went to work crafting a presidential resume in the Senate, Bill capitalized on his new super elite status as a former president. And the Clintons' way of cashing in on that access was by exploiting misery and disaster. In 2001, in response to a major earthquake in India, the Clintons joined the heads of Goldman Sachs and Citibank and embarked on a false philanthropy model that would define their Clinton Foundation. These development and relief charities act as an insertion mule for Western business. For example, some of the Clinton Foundation's so-called development projects in India, Africa, and Central America include forming for-profit farming corporations that exploit small farmers. The donations typically end up back in the pockets of donors. Their companies getting the so-called development contracts to build up mobile networks and real estate. In the past 15 years, the Clinton Foundation has grown into a lucrative fraternity of the rich and powerful, which boasts of having projects in 180 different countries. Including its numerous spin-off affiliates, it reported total assets of over $351 million in 2013. The sources of cash for this political machine say everything about the true nature of this charity. As a nonprofit, the Clinton Foundation is not required to disclose donors or contributions. All of the funds disclosed on the website are in ranges and unspecified for what purpose. Other than a $25 million partnership with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Clinton Foundation's large donor base is a motley crew of criminal corporations and police state monarchies. Giving a gracious $10 million is the brutal theocratic kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Matching the $10 million is the Viktor Pinchuk Foundation, Ukrainian billionaire oligarch who pledged tens of millions more to the Clinton Global Initiative to, quote, modernize Ukraine while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. Donating in the $1 to $5 million range are Gulf state monarchies Oman, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar and Kuwait, Saudi billionaire Nasir al-Rashid, ExxonMobil, Dow Chemical, Walmart, a company she has close ties to, having served on the board of directors from 1986 to...
Whoops. Okay, this is a hippie from Olima, about a okie from Muskogee. Proud to be a hippie from Olima, where we're friendly to the squares and all the straights. We still take in strangers when they're haggard and we cannot find anybody to hate. Certainly not that okie from Muskogee, excuse the expression, but I feel for him because his brother got those southern chains slapped on him being stop-lost into this bogus war in Afghanistan. Now, we all know the fertilizer bomb mainstream media's version of that. Well, just like 93 was not a fertilizer bomb, okay? The World Trade Center, yeah, those are... You know, and the Oklahoma City bombing, those are, never mind, the bombing them, completely different two things. One was a car parked in the basement, but the other was, just like the other things that are called car bomb, but you see the mushroom cloud, and never mind. Whoops, where do we go?
Yeah.
happening over and over again, but that's some other version. That's what, where were we? That's what this reminded me of.
Two, Coca-Cola, Pfizer, Barclays Capital, Goldman Sachs, and Boeing. The number two defense contractor in the country. In the lower $1 million range are such exemplary institutions as Monsanto, Chevron, General Electric, more banks, Bank of America, Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, UBS, Bank of California, and media giant Fox's News Corp. Then there's the Soros Foundation, an organization that claims to build, quote, tolerant democracies around the world, whatever that means. It's a win-win relationship, one that only continues to grow. The Clintons get massive financial support to run their machine, and their contributors get the perks of a loyal advocate in a position of power. As Hillary ascends off of this corporate sponsorship, the more favors she can grant, leading to more contributions, and so on. And while Hillary was in the Senate, these favors for her donors were numerous. Manufacturing giant known as Corning gave hundreds of thousands to the Clintons through their foundation and speaking fees. In return, Hillary introduced Senate legislation to allot hundreds of millions in federal aid to purchase Corning products. Notorious criminal enterprises Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae were also Clinton Foundation sponsors who won big by investing in Senator Clinton. She played a key role in blocking measures to regulate them, helping them reap super profits before facilitating the crash of the economy. The deal was good for business while Hillary was in the Senate, but the plan was always something bigger. After checking the box of having experience and having built a robust financial backing and political network, Hillary announced her bid for president in 2006, shortly after her Senate re-election. She was supposed to be the shoo-in. It was her time, as they said. But then everything blew up in her face. Mass opposition to the Iraq War marginalized her as a candidate. A little-known Barack Obama was flung to the front for his rhetoric against the war, while Hillary ardently defended her vote for the war throughout her entire campaign. Knocked off a presumed ride to the White House, she flailed trying to capture a changing Democratic Party base. Her campaign was criticized for its slew of dirty tricks, including an array of voter suppression tactics mainly aimed at the youth. Most pathetic was the release of a photo of Obama in a turban, pandering to Islamophobia and the strategy of thinly veiled racism the Clintons employed back in the 90s. Obama's campaign manager, David Plouffe, said the photo was the most shameful, offensive fear-mongering we've seen from either party in this election. But none of the schemes worked. And while today Hillary's media surrogates continue to call on close competitor Bernie Sanders to drop out, back in 2008, she held out to the very bitter end, refusing to give in when Obama was the clear winner. She only acquiesced and backed Obama after a closed-door negotiation, where she was promised a promotion and a path to succeed him. As Secretary of State, the rewards for her sponsors grew to a new level, and so too did donations to the Clintons. Her corruption is exemplified by the fact that 181 donors to the Clinton Foundation simultaneously lobbied the State Department while she was in charge. She used her position to divvy out repayment favors in a variety of ways. She funneled money from the State Department to Clinton friends and sponsors, like securing tens of millions in government grants for her dear friend and owner of for-profit education firm, Lorette Education, Inc. She also used her new title to help negotiate business deals between her donor friends and other heads of state. For example, she brought billionaire mining magnate Frank Giostra to meet the president of Colombia, scoring him access to pristine forests and coastline to be mined and drilled by his company. She did the same in Kazakhstan and beyond. Hillary convinced other countries to give up permits to be pillaged. In one incident, she convinced the Haitian government to issue a rare mining permit. The contract went out to a mining company that not only shells out millions to the Clinton Foundation, but her brother sits on its board of directors. She also flew around the world on the taxpayer's dime to act as a saleswoman for American corporations. For her sponsor Boeing, she made a personal pitch to the Russian government to purchase their jets. The result was a $3.7 billion contract for Boeing. The Clintons got a kickback of $900K as a giant thank you from the war profiteer. But none of these deals compare to her role as an international arms dealer. Her State Department approved a whopping $165 billion worth of commercial arms sales to 20 nations that are also Clinton Foundation sponsors, doubling U.S. arms sales to those countries under George W. Bush. These lucrative deals are undeniably rewards for paying off the Clintons. The amount of the reward directly corresponded to the amount of their donation. Her top donor, Saudi Arabia, scored the biggest, and so on down the line. Beyond the obvious step up from her corporate shilling as Senator and Secretary of State, wreaking economic and environmental havoc to line the pockets of Clinton coffers, a President Hillary puts us in great danger of catastrophic war, another fact she's proven time and again over the entirety of her career. Clinton's war record is perhaps most exemplified by her endorsement from one of the world's most notorious war criminals, the Butcher of Cambodia, Henry Kissinger. On the campaign trail, she bragged, "I was very flattered when Henry Kissinger said I ran the State Department better than anybody had run it in a long time. So I have an idea about what it's going to take to make our government work more efficiently." Yes, the relationship between Kissinger and Clinton is very close. Not only did she consult with him regularly as Secretary of State, her and Bill frequently vacationed with the Kissingers. Her other foreign policy advisors are quite similar, including PNAC founder neoconservative Robert Kagan, and even shares advisors with Republican war hawks like Ted Cruz. Her support for the criminal invasion of Iraq has come back to haunt her once again in this election. And now she's written it off as a mistake. And in one instance, seemed to blame it on being bribed by George Bush with state funds for New York.
So I'm sitting there in the Oval Office, and Bush says to me, "What do you need?" I said, "I need $20 billion to rebuild, yeah, you know, New York." He said, "You got it." And he was good to his word.
But she didn't just vote for the war. She was a key advocate of it, leading a right-wing minority among Democratic Party Congress members that favored the invasion over the old tactics of empire's domination. She called for, quote, unequivocal support for Bush's firm leadership and decisive action. She spread the lie that Iraq was in violation of UN resolutions, despite the actual weapons inspectors arguing the contrary, and continued to assert Iraq had WMDs despite it being, by that time, thoroughly debunked. As the U.S. and Iraqi body count grew and complete disaster ensued, Hillary still went around the country asserting that she had no regrets giving Bush total authority to invade and occupy Iraq. In 2007, she voted to give Bush the same authority again, with a blank check to attack Iran by trying to label their military a terrorist organization, a move rejected even by pro-war Democrats.
Today, Joe Lieberman, who authored the Iraq resolution, has authored another resolution, and it is essentially a fig leaf to let George Bush go to war with Iran. And I want to congratulate Biden for voting against it, Dodd for voting against it, and I'm ashamed of you, Hillary, for voting for it. You're not going to get another shot at this, because what's happened, if this war ensues, we invade, and they're looking for an excuse to do it. And Obama was not even there to vote.
Senator Clinton, I want to give you a chance to respond.
In 2008, Senator Clinton made the chilling and completely repulsive admission that if president, she would not rule out using nuclear weapons on Afghanistan and Pakistan. After her promotion to Secretary of State, she boldly planted a flag in the Obama administration to establish the Hillary Doctrine. According to The Nation, 24 current and former administration officials, foreign diplomats, friends, and outside analysts described Mrs. Clinton as almost always the advocate of the most aggressive actions considered by Mr. Obama's national security team. Of course, she joined Obama in creating and leading terrible fronts to human life and rights, like the murderous drone campaign in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. The program's mass civilian casualties, she says, she takes with a grain of salt. However, on other issues, she took the lead, showing how she would steer the empire's ship as she aimed for the presidency. In her book, she brags about her lead role backing the 2009 coup of the democratically elected leader in Honduras, further plunging the country into violence and instability. Also that year, when it was long clear that the Afghanistan war was an endless, unwinnable crisis, she lobbied to send far more troops in Obama's blood-soaked troop surge. When it was time to keep the promise of bringing those troops home, then Secretary of Defense Robert Gates says that Hillary argued forcefully against withdrawing the surge troops. She continues to advocate a never-ending U.S. occupation there. The same thing happened when it came to Iraq. Hillary led a minority that tried to convince Obama to leave thousands more American combat troops there, permanently. Today, she's to the right of Obama on Iraq yet again, advocating for even more U.S. troops, more combat. Then came what has been dubbed Hillary's War, a move Obama recently admitted was his biggest mistake. Oil-rich Libya is where Clinton sought to showcase her military doctrine. Masked in sinister right-to-protect jargon, Hillary is well known as the primary advocate for U.S.-led attack to overthrow the Libyan state, to feed on its resources, and hijack the Arab Spring.
Yes, we came, we saw, he died.
She laughed about an African leader being lynched on television, his country tossed into an era of unimaginable pain. Right afterward, what everyone predicted happened. Strife from a shattered state, decimated infrastructure, and U.S. armed rebel fighters has turned Libya into a new bastion for ISIS.
The scandal of Benghazi isn't that Hillary allowed Americans to die, but that those Americans were there funneling weapons to extremists in a country she had just helped destroy. And what did Hillary take away from the incident? That there should have been more American troops.
We have learned the hard way. When America is absent, especially from unstable places, there are consequences.
Yeah, I don't think it was because America was absent, but because they had just carpet-bombed the country and injected its entire government. And on Syria, she's led the push for war from the beginning.
She personally joined the shame general, David Petraeus, in creating the CIA-led Friends of Syria insurgency. She was among the first and most forceful in pushing for a no-fly zone to overthrow the Syrian state. Even as recently as 2015, she had a high-profile break with Obama over the issue, and even in recent debates had to continue to advocate for it. A no-fly zone means war. U.S. bombing of all Syrian anti-aircraft defense systems, and much more. It would undoubtedly trigger a broader regional conflict involving nuclear powers. When it comes to Israel, she has rebuked Obama on the most mild criticisms of Israeli war crimes, and vows to give the occupation more aid than any other candidate. But the biggest apparent danger of a regime under the Hillary Doctrine is the risk of new U.S. wars.
If Hillary was a proud leader of what's accepted as the biggest foreign policy catastrophes of both the Bush and Obama administrations, what else should be expected of a Hillary administration? One little discussed threat posed by a Hillary presidency is that she spent her time in office paving the way for war with Iran.
When asked in a recent Democratic debate what enemy she was most
we all know.
She answered, the Iranians. In the 2008 campaign, she was ostracized for her aggressive comments about Iran.
They might be in their nuclear weapons program in the next 10 years, during which they might foolishly consider launching an attack on Israel. We would be able to totally obliterate them.
She's always advocated the most hawkish approaches to Iran. But in recent years, she's made a point to separate herself from Obama as the more strong arm than the sly war by sanctions and subversion. With the signing of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, Obama was staunch in refusing to threaten Iran with a military attack if they violated the agreement. However, Hillary went over his head to show her sword was sharper, declaring her position on television. We will not hesitate to take military action if Iran attempts to obtain a nuclear weapon. Given her proud support for a war of aggression for non-existent WMDs in Iraq, no one should trust her standards. Nobody doubts that a U.S. war with Iran would likely be catastrophic and wider-reaching than the Iraq War. This great danger facing the lives of countless people around the world should never be understated. But it's not just Iran. In every part of the world, from Latin America to Asia, Hillary Clinton has made clear that she will choose the path of death and destruction every time, no matter the consequences. We know they're going to use fear of the Republican nominee to pressure everyone into supporting her. They don't want us to know that we can and we should fight both sides. And as a woman, I completely reject Hillary's brand of bourgeois feminism because it leaves out millions of immigrant women, poor women, and the women under her bombs around the world.
Is reminiscent of Orwellian doublespeak. War is peace, slavery is freedom, ignorance is strength, and now, according to Clinton, coups are democratic. In her attempt to avert a challenge by Bernie Sanders, Clinton has tried to recast herself as a progressive. Unfortunately for her, she has a long political track record that proves the opposite. One of her biggest blunders, which happened during her tenure as Secretary of State, was her handling of the 2009 coup in Honduras that saw the left-leaning president Manuel Zelaya kidnapped by the military and whisked away in the middle of the night in his pajamas. Clinton likes to pretend that her role was helpful, and she confessed in her autobiography, Hard Choices, that it was her intervention that prevented Zelaya from returning to power. And without a doubt, her role in the coup has come back to haunt her. Bruto Cáceres, the world-renowned Honduran environmentalist who was assassinated for her activism, called Clinton out specifically for her role in helping to install a repressive regime that remains in power to this very day.
Y ella ahí reconoce que ellos siempre evitaron que Mel Zelaya retornara a la presidencia.
When asked about her role by the New York Daily News, instead of showing any remorse, she reiterated her support for the coup, actually arguing that it was democratic. Worse still, she called for even further military intervention in Honduras, suggesting that the remedy for Central America lies in a strategy similar to what was done in Colombia called Plan Colombia, which has been linked to serious human rights abuses. So it's easy to see that with a perspective like hers, a Clinton presidency would undeniably be a cause for serious concern for all of Latin America.
8 pages of